Thank you, my very dear friend, Monsignor Higgins. I'm sure glad he showed up tonight, otherwise they'd still be searching for someone to introduce me. But I've never let such a challenge stand in the way of my unburdening myself of a speech when I thought the time had arrived. I must say that showing this platform was one Joe Ryle is somewhat intimidated, because no one comes with the impeccable credentials that he has speaking to an audience of this kind on the subject matter to which you address yourself. I presume my only qualification is longevity, survival, and don't think that's a quality that should be relegated to an insignificant place in your struggle, because you've got to have staying power. And if I reflect briefly this evening on some of the historical aspects of the struggle, which now has been passed on to your hands and others, it's only, I think, because we have to see the dimensions of the struggle of democracy within the trade union movement in its broader aspects and its broader ramifications. My last visit to Michigan, which was my home for so many long and hectic years, was to join at Flint, Michigan, and to share the platform with Doug Fraser in the unveiling of three historic bronze plaques commemorating great historic events in the 1937 sit-down strike against General Motors. Quite frankly, I never thought I'd live to see the day when bronze plaques commemorating that history was erected on General Motors' property or on the sidewalks of the city of Flint. And I said on that occasion, it's much more important in understanding American history that we know where the auto workers made their first stand and where General Custer made his last stand. And I think the history of this nation of ours, which has been one of continuing struggle, is one that is still not fully understood and comprehended, perhaps least of all by those of us who've been a part of the trade union movement, which has written one of the most glorious chapters in the ongoing and the continuing and still unfinished American Revolution. To have lived through that and the great civil rights struggle, another glorious chapter in the American Revolution, is to know that ordinary people out of the shops, mines, and mills are really the backbone of what we call American democracy. Perhaps it takes events over in Gdansk, Poland to remind us that a people living under a brutal authoritarian regime turns to a newly founded democratic trade union movement as its most important hope to realize a full measure of freedom and democracy. Now, you and the people whose heritage you represent have contributed enormously to the quality of what we call American democracy. Every important achievement in the long history of this nation of ours has been contributed to, far out of proportion to its membership numbers, by the trade unions of this nation. And while we struggle to improve the character and the quality of what we call trade union democracy, let us never forget its important relationship to the society in which we live and the survival of what we call democracy. Because just as freedom and liberty are indivisible, so an attack on democracy democratic rights anywhere in this land is a threat to the democratic rights of others. And to express in solidarity a helping hand to those who struggle because of the denial of basic freedoms and basic trade union rights, wherever it may be, in whatever union, is to express a solidarity. And one ought to be proud of extending that helping hand to others to safeguard or to extend the frontiers of democracy in all of its forms and practices. And I, for one, have never considered that I was an outsider in any aspect of that struggle. In Morgantown, West Virginia, where I spent a year at the university before I found my way to work at Waterside in Detroit, first in the lines of the unemployed, and later working our way through what was the College of the City of Detroit. But when I was in West Virginia, I spent every 3 hours I had from studies walking around in Scott's Run, a hellhole if ever there was one, where miners lived in company shops and were exploited to the same degree that they were when my father, many years before, as the elected head of the Central Labor Council in Wheeling, West Virginia, was asked to go into the mountains of West Virginia and Kentucky to help the coal miners. Was he an outsider when he went there to offer his helping hand? I think not. And I felt I continued not only a family tradition, but a trade union obligation, and an American obligation to see to it that wherever the democratic rights of citizens or workers are in jeopardy, that there are those who will not stand on the sidelines, but will speak out in their defense and offer a helping hand of solidarity. Today enjoy a greater degree of internal union democracy than is customary in some other unions, and I realize this hypothesis is controversial in the minds of some, but if that is the case, it is because they had to fight damn hard for it on three fronts at the same time. And let us not forget that they were embattled on three fronts simultaneously. And it is nothing short of a miracle that the Auto Workers Union survived as an institution. We not only took on the richest and most powerful corporation in the world, General Motors, in a strike far earlier than we were prepared to take them on, and I still suspect to this day that the first strikes in Atlanta, Georgia, which was hardly the stronghold of militant trade unionism in those days, were deliberately, prematurely triggered to force us into a showdown before we were ready. But we took on General Motors in a brutal battle, and had we fought according to the old rules in the picket lines outside the gates of the factories, we wouldn't have survived. But the non-violent nature of the sit-down strike gave us a degree of physical protection from the police and the municipalities, the sheriffs, every aspect of law enforcement in this land, all the way to the inner chambers of J. Edgar Hoover, were lined up against the auto workers in their right to organize. And of course, the corporation had its private arsenal and its hired Pinkerton agents. After the Battle of Bull's Run in Fort, when I had to leave at the recommendation of the officers of the unit, otherwise a General Motors judge who had some $300,000 of General Motors stock was about to lock me up for physically tearing down Fisher Rock. I want you to know what a Superman I was in those days. And I took an overnight train to Anderson, Indiana, where personal director of the Guideline plant of General Motors, the leading citizen in the town, had addressed a motley crowd that could only be described as a mixture between the Klan and the Black Legion. The corporation had plied them freely with liquor and told them to march on the Union headquarters and drive the outside agitators out of town, which they proceeded to do and brutally beat up all of the organizers on the staff, save my wife, who was the first woman organizer in the UAW. And when I was sent down on an overnight train to be director of organization in the state of Indiana, I thought what a joy it would be to join my bride of a few months. It took me 4 days to find her, because she knew the only contact I had was the secretary treasurer of our local union. And she knew by then that he was a Pinkerton agent, only I didn't know it. The UAW survived that. And it survived the police and the courts and the J. Edgar Hoovers. J.R. will know the day when he and I went to see the Attorney General of the United States, 3 years after the first shotgun attack on Walter, and 2 years after a hard agent fired a double-barreled shotgun full at my face, ripping out my right eye, penetrating my throat and chest. And although the President of the United States had asked the FBI to intervene, and the United States Senate, Republicans and Democrats alike, joined in one of the few unanimous decisions that body ever made, demanding the FBI get into the case, J.R. went to see the Attorney General after still another year had passed. The Attorney General was baffled at first as to why J. Edgar didn't get in. He said, "I'll call him again." When J. got a hold of him the following day, he said, Edgar said, quote, "What the hell does the UAW don't you think every time a new woman gets raped, the FBI will enter the case? Period." End quote. But the labor movement survived that kind of conspiracy against it at every level. There's nothing short of a murder. But then you compound that picture with a labor leadership so bureaucratic that it denied in the early days the other workers the right to elect their own officials. We had to fight for that right. And to be chartered as a separate union, that old labor bureaucracy served notice on the General Motors Corporation in the middle of our state, struggling for our lives. They had long been negotiating with these upstarts. So that was signed agreement with the FBI. And worse still, when we undertook the more difficult task to organize Ford, where Harry Bennett, the ex-pugilist, then personnel director, had a private army of 5,000 armed servicemen inside the River Rouge plant to intimidate those who dared to wear a union button or who were seen attending a union meeting. And these servicemen regularly would visit the wives of Ford workers and warn them that if their husbands didn't stay away from the union meetings, they'd be fired, or worse yet, they might not come home. That Harry Bennett was invited to sign a sweetheart agreement with a rep union led by an ousted president of the UAW, Homer Martin, who entered into secret negotiations with the Ford Motor Company in the middle of the strike to establish our right to exist. William Green was in direct telephone conversation with Harry Bennett at the same time. You think you had problems? We survived them. And you will survive them, and the quality of trade union democracy and the quality of American life will be better than your efforts. You know, we're a long ways from what you could describe as a perfect union. In any industry, we may never reach perfection in the sense of having the kind of democracy that fits all the textbook descriptions. But it is the search for that, like the search for truth, that keeps us going. And it is as elusive at times as is the search for truth. But let me tell you, without that search, the prospects for the survival of what we call American democracy are very glum indeed. And I think when we talk about problems that arise in different unions, and they will arise in all of them, including my own UAW, of which I am deeply proud, but I see danger signs on the horizon there too. And Monsignor Higgins, I want to say, I thank the good Lord every time I think about the UAW, that we have the good sense to establish a public review board. That public review board does not solve all the dangers and all the threats to membership rights and democratic procedures within the union. But its very existence serves as a constant warning to whatever set of officers may succeed to power, that it be done carefully. Because it is not fun for a group of elected officers to be reversed by a body like that. And they have been on occasions. And it's taken them some time to get over the embarrassment of that and the explanations that are necessary. But in the crucible of battling on three fronts at the same time, we establish some vital procedures in the UAW that have survived many long years. We used to have to break chairs over the table to be heard at a convention to get the floor and speak. And they were riotous affairs. And finally we got through even the most bureaucratic leadership and the most party-indoctrinated leadership, because that was the last of the great internal battles. We got through to them that no matter how controversial the issue was, if there was an opposite view in the union, there would be a speaker for and a speaker against. And that became common procedure in local after local and in the national conventions of the UAW. If an issue came to the floor behind which there was only 1% of the delegates in support, they automatically got 50% of the time on the floor of the convention. Sometimes they have a little more now. And a skillful chairman knows how to use that to his advantage too. But I don't care how small and how insignificant a caucus group may appear in the union, their right to be heard. But more importantly than the right to be heard is the educational process. Having issues brought to the floor and debated. Nothing is so deadly as a convention where everything is cut and dry. And you virtually have to organize circuses to keep attendance. Where there's controversy, there's interest. I'm not suggesting that every union should go out and stimulate the formation of the opposition caucuses. They'll come of their own accord if you've got the courage to debate the issues. And quite frankly, I don't know how we can expect new leadership to come out of the ranks if they aren't trained in the give and take of debate of issues on the floor of local unions and in district meetings and in national conventions. The leadership that came out of the first sit-down strike, incredible in its quality. There was hardly a corporate executive that would stand on a public rostrum and debate committing any shop stewards out of the plant. Because in the rough and tumble and the give and take, they developed skill, they developed a comprehension, a knowledge in depth of the issues that they felt strongly about. And when you come out of that kind of experience, union democracy is not something that's distant, it's something close at hand. The sort of political democracy which you exercise once a year, best on a local level and once every 4 years at the national level, every day in your working life, you have a chance to participate in that kind of live democracy. And that's why the trade union movement is so vital to the workers of this nation and so vital to the people over in Poland even. And that's why it is important we do everything possible to keep that spark of union democracy alive and healthy and growing and flourishing in every branch of the trade union movement. I don't care how many full-page editorial steel labor may write castigating me. When I heard they had cheated Ed Sadowski out of an election that he'd won, fair and square, I said that's an affront to every trade unionist in this land. It's an affront to every American citizen. And we need to identify our struggle for trade union democracy more closely with the struggle to maintain democratic life and democratic practices in the nation as a whole. There's so much I'd like to say on this occasion. You've been through long workshops, and you've got some ahead of you. And you've got some important thoughts that Gerard is going to leave with you tonight that you want to mull over, and I'm not going to exhaust you with the length of the speech that anyone bearing my name usually calls for. I do want to add one other thought that may seem far afield from your deliberations here. No one who has spent as many years as I did deeply involved in international trade union work could be unmindful of the enormous importance of democratic trade unionism in the United States to working people elsewhere in the world, and the danger that the power that you have might be used to corrupt democratic trade unions in other parts of the world. I speak of things that ought to be common knowledge to all of you, but it appears that we have to be shaken up periodically by new disclosures to remind us that there are some issues still unresolved. I refer, of course, to some of the activities that are carried out in the name of international labor solidarity that are corrupting, that are undermining the very fiber of democratic trade unions in other lands where they struggle maybe on more than three fronts at the same time and need a genuine helping hand and not the liability of a program that is degrading, that is more an expression of American trade union colonialism than it is a gesture of solidarity. I mention this because the events in Poland are perhaps the most historic event since the last Great War in terms of the impact it is likely to have. And I would not want to see the good name of the American trade union movement pollute a relationship there, as it has in many lands south of the border and elsewhere in this world. I refer to the activities of three institutes, ostensibly official branches of the AFL-CIO, the American Institute for Free Labor Development, or AFLD in Latin America, the American African Labor Committee, and the Asian Institute for Free Labor Development. The boards of directors supervising that program ostensibly intended to train democratic trade unionists in other parts of the world. There are more corporate executives on that board of directors than there are trade unionists. Who of you, not even your most bitter opponent in your union, would be so bold as to suggest a training program for new leadership in your union and name J.P. Grace, or the head of Amazon, the Popper, or the head of IT&T to serve on the board of directors and decide who was to be trained and what kind of courses were to be offered. And yet that is being done in your name by the three institutes of the AFL-CIO. I said this while President Meany was alive. I wrote it in the book, and hence I did not wait for his demise to say this. But on numerous occasions, the president of the NFL-CIO, in sworn testimony before the Senate of the United States, said that 25% of the total income of the NFL-CIO went to help workers in other lands. I don't know of a single trade union leader who's been re-elected to office who spent 25% of his total budget outside the United States. Now, why did he so exaggerate the monies being spent by the NFL-CIO? Because they were spending monies far in excess of what any official budget would show. There has not been one Secretary of Labor who's supposed to look over the financial reports of the NFL-CIO for their accuracy who's ever called that into question. Why? Spending money is far in excess of what any official budget would show. There has not been one Secretary of Labor who's supposed to look over the financial reports of the NFL-CIO for their accuracy who's ever called that into question. Why? Because every administration has found it convenient to pour many millions of dollars into the coffers of institutes such as those, carry on activities which the State Department or Central Intelligence or others wish to have done, but would rather do it under the name of a bona fide trade union. And I say to you, we have an interest with workers in other lands. Abraham Lincoln many years ago said that next to the relationship within the family, our kinship with workers of other lands is the next most important. We have an enormous obligation to them, and I could cite chapter and verse where democratic trade unions were undermined, destroyed, competing rump unions financed by money from stateside, because the politics of that country was not in harmony with what the State Department or someone in Central Intelligence wanted. That's a terrible indictment to make, and it's been hovering over the labor movement many long years. And before another great inquiry splashes across the headlines of the daily newspapers, giving the American trade union movement another block eye, we have to clean up our houses. And every union that's involved in programs of that kind are asked the kind of questions that need to be asked about the funding. Who serves on what board? And who's calling the shots of these institutes? You can't decide about this because to do so is to say what some Germans told me at the end of the war. They didn't know about all these camps. Well, it's too damn bad. They should have known. They should have made it their business to know. And it's not enough that you care about the internal democracy of the steelworkers and the Teamsters or the UAW or AFSCME or the clothing workers or any other. It's not enough if there are things being done in your name and my name that you really can't justify. You gotta ask about it. Now I know that's a heavy additional item to add to your already overburdened agenda. But it shouldn't be just on the conscience of a few people. It should be something that you can relate to and get to the very power centers of the unions that are still engaged as transmission belts for these funds, or who are actively participating in the recruitment of workers overseas for these kind of phony training programs. That's a big job, but it's not one that a group that's as committed and as concerned as we are can grapple with and make progress towards the solution of. Democracy and freedom are indivisible. We can't survive in one area of the United States or in one union alone. And we can't survive in one part of this world alone. We need a hell of a lot of allies. If they know us as we really are, with all of our warts and all of our mistakes and shortcomings, we'll have a hell of a lot more friends around the world than we will have by those who pretend to put a false front on the activities that he carried out in Ireland. Thank you all very much.